From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, bluegrass star Earl Scruggs. He perfected the three-finger picking technique that became standard in bluegrass. Early in his career, he played with Bill Monroe. In 1948, he and guitarist Lester Flatt left Monroe to form their own now-famous group. Scruggs is featured with Ricky Skaggs and Doc Watson on the new CD, The Three Pickers. Also, a poet tries to teach high school English and learns that cowering behind her desk is not an effective technique. We talked to Elizabeth Gold. Her new memoir, Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity, is about her months as a replacement teacher. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council unanimously passed a resolution that urges countries to provide troops and money to help rebuild Iraq. Secretary of State Colin Powell says he believes the UN endorsement will make it easier to raise money at a donors' conference. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
France, Russia, and Germany have already told the U.S. they won't be sending troops to Iraq or offering more financial support, even though they voted for the Security Council resolution. Secretary of State Powell got the message, but said he still hopes countries will reflect on the needs of Iraqi people.
This isn't a matter of supporting the United States or the coalition. This is a matter of helping people who are in need. And I hope all of the nations, in light of this new resolution, will reexamine their approach to this in that light.
Many countries that opposed the war have been reluctant to fund the rebuilding effort. The United Nations and the World Bank are trying to make it easier by setting up an international trust fund that would not be controlled by the U.S. occupation forces. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Palestinian security officials arrested three members of the militant group, the Popular Resistance Committees, who are suspected of involvement in yesterday's attack on an American diplomatic convoy in Gaza. Three Americans were killed in that attack. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian officials arrested the men in the Jabalia refugee camp near the site of yesterday's roadside bomb. A Palestinian security official said one of the suspects opened fire, wounding seven people, among them five Palestinian policemen. A spokesman for the Popular Resistance Committees denied involvement in yesterday's bombing in Gaza and said they were stunned by what he called the unjustified arrests. Israeli security officials said the resistance committees consist of former Palestinian security officials and disgruntled members of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement. But Palestinian analysts said the resistance committees have members from all Palestinian factions. Israeli officials dismissed today's arrests as designed to placate the U.S. Linda Gradstein, NPR News. Jerusalem.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said today that he has complete confidence in the FBI's investigation of a leak that disclosed the name of an undercover CIA officer.
I am directing and will do everything within my power to make sure that this investigation is conducted in a way which is professional, thorough, prompt, and complete.
Ashcroft said he hasn't ruled out appointing a special counsel to take over the investigation. Democrats in Congress say Ashcroft should recuse himself, arguing that a presidential appointee can't avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest when he investigates the Bush administration. In stocks, the Dow lost 11 points to close at 9,791. This is NPR News. China said today that it will eventually launch a space lab and then a space station. The statement came hours after China's first man in space returned safely to Earth. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
The second most senior officer in China's space program, Jiang Qingwei, said that the successful mission of the manned Shenzhou 5 spacecraft was just the first step for China. But another official, director of the China Manned Space Engineering Office, Xie Mingbao, said that the next space launch could be as much as 2 years away. Xie added, though, that spacewalks and a docking between two spacecraft are among China's next goals. He confirmed that China has spent more than $2 billion on the manned space program so far. China's first astronaut, Yang Liwei, touched down on the grasslands north of Beijing and has returned to the Chinese capital as a new national hero. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
Authorities are still trying to account for at least two people who are listed as missing following yesterday's Staten Island ferry crash in New York Harbor. At least 10 people were killed and more than 60 hurt when the vessel struck a pier. Authorities are also trying to determine whether the pilot of the ferry lost consciousness before the crash. Witnesses say the ferry never slowed down as it approached a maintenance pier hundreds of feet from the normal docking space. The pilot, 55-year-old Richard Smith, reportedly left the scene of the accident, went home, and attempted suicide. He's now in critical condition at a New York hospital. Officials are looking into the possibility that Smith may have failed to take crucial medication. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 11 points to close at 1,950. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Earl Scruggs, is one of the most important players in the history of bluegrass. He perfected the three-finger style of banjo picking that became standard in bluegrass. Scruggs joined Bill Monroe's band in 1945, the band that virtually invented bluegrass. In 1948, Scruggs and guitar player Lester Flatt left Monroe to form their own group. Flatt and Scruggs became one of the most popular acts in country music. Their hit Foggy Mountain Breakdown became even more famous when it was used on the soundtrack of the movie Bonnie and Clyde. They also crossed over by playing the theme for the TV series The Beverly Hillbillies. In 1969, Earl Scruggs formed his own band, the Earl Scruggs Review, with his sons Gary and Randy. Scruggs has been inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, and this year he got his own star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Along with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs, Earl Scruggs is featured on the new CD, The Three Pickers. Let's start with a track. This is Feast Here Tonight. Earl Scruggs, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, you grew up during the Depression. Your father died when you were four. How did your family make a living when he died?
He was a farmer also, so I stayed on the farm until I got old enough to get a job in the factory. And on the farm, you work from daylight till dark, and in the factory, you work 8 hours, so I thought that was great.
Right. Who did you hear play banjo before you started playing yourself? I mean, I've read that there was no radio in your house when you were growing up.
No.
Who did you hear? How did you hear them?
We had a banjo in our home. My father played the old-style banjo, so I had a banjo there, and my brother Horace had a guitar, and so we just started playing just old tunes that we'd heard before, and then a little later we got a Sears Roebuck radio and started listening to some, mainly the Grand Ole Opry and some programs like that. But as far as the style banjo that I play, nobody had played it before me. And the only thing that is different from my playing from what I'd heard is I had a three-finger roll, later been called Scruggs style. But it seemed to help me to play slow tunes as well as up-tempo tunes. Most of the banjo playing in the old days were hoedown type tunes, up-tempo tunes.
So could you put into words what your style of picking is, the three-finger style?
Well, it's just what you hear. It involves, It's a little misleading, say three fingers. It's actually two fingers, middle and index finger, and your thumb. And it's a kind of, some of the rules will go, if you number your thumb one, the index two, and your middle finger three, it's like a 1-2-3 roll over and over. But to do a tune, it's like trying to say every word with the same same amount of syllables in the word. You've got to alternate the roll some to make the tune flow.
Since you didn't have a radio when you were very young, and you didn't have a record player,
yeah.
So you're just like hearing, you know, musicians who may have been, you know, living where you were. How did you come up with your style of playing, with your style of picking?
I guess the old days, you have one main room. You have what you take company to when they come, that you don't use every day. So I was in what we call the front room with a banjo one day, and I was in a mode where if somebody had asked me what was I thinking about, and I bet you've been in that mode yourself, you couldn't tell them what you was thinking about. You was just kind of sitting there. And I was picking the banjo, and I was playing a tune that's still played today called Reuben. And when I realized what I was doing, I was playing the way that I play now. It was like having a dream and wake up, you're actually playing the tune. So that was the mode I was in and what I was doing when I learned exactly what I'm doing today.
So did you think like, oh my God, this is a breakthrough, or did you just not make, you know, think much of it at the moment?
Well, my brother said, I came out of the room saying, I got it. So I didn't know what I had, but he said that's what I was saying. But anyway, I played to play Reuben. It's tuned in a different key from standard tuning, and I played that one tune the rest of the week, and my oldest brother, Junie, came over on Saturday. He came walking up the road, and then I got out on the edge of the porch and started playing Reuben, and as he started going to the house, he said, is that all you can play? And that shocked the fire out of me, because I hadn't retuned the banjo to another key and tried another tune.
Now, you joined Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys in 1945. This was the group that basically created the sound that's become known as bluegrass. When you joined the band, could you hear that something different was happening there?
Oh, yeah. Nobody had had this style of banjo in the group, and he just did the type of tunes that would make the banjo sound good. So it was a good shot to start with, because he had the Grand Ole Opry exposure, and that gave me a lot of exposure when I went to work with him. And it got immediate attention, because nobody had heard that kind of a banjo picking. So it caught on real fast with the public.
Why don't we hear one of your recordings with Bill Monroe from 1947? This is one of the famous ones, Bluegrass Breakdown, with Bill Monroe on mandolin, Lester Flatt, guitar, my guest Earl Scruggs, banjo, recorded in 1947. Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, recorded in 1947 with my guest Earl Scruggs on banjo. You're considered one of the first banjo players to be a serious musician and to not be a comic with a banjo. A lot of banjo players before you would tell comic monologues or sing comic songs with banjo accompaniment. And in fact, there's a story that may be apocryphal that Uncle Dave Macon, the banjo player, said after hearing you the first time, he ain't one damn bit funny. Did you realize that you were a departure from that, a departure from the kind of comic tradition of banjo playing?
I used to try to study to see if it's some kind of routine I wanted to do as being a comedian, because everybody player, and there were very few, but they all were comedians, and kind of used the banjo as a prop to get into their comedy routine. But all my interest was just in picking not only tunes, but songs behind singers, not only in the lead part, but doing a backup. You know what I mean by backup?
Mm-hmm.
Playing an alto or something to support the singer. So that's where my interest was as a lead picker with the banjo, but also a supporter with the banjo.
What was life on the road like with Bill Monroe?
It was terrible. If I hadn't been 21 years old and full of energy, just came off the farm and a thread mill where I could, you know, I thought to do an hour show on the road was a pushover compared to 8 hours in the mill or from sunup to sundown on the farm. And music was my love, so to get into a group that had good singing and playing, and Bill had that, especially good singing and had good fiddle player. So I went in, and it just seemed to make a full band, especially for that style of music. That was long before anybody had tagged it as bluegrass. It was just country music, but it really made an outstanding group for that day and time, especially.
But why did you hate traveling so much with the band?
Why did I hate it?
Mm-hmm.
It was because we did it 24 hours a day, practically. Back then, there was only two-lane highways, and he traveled in a 41 Chevrolet car. And we'd leave after the opera on Saturday night and maybe work down in South Georgia, about as far as you could get for a Sunday afternoon show, and on down to Miami someplace for Monday or Tuesday, and work till about Thursday and start working back to Nashville. So it was just, you'd only be in Nashville long enough to do the Grand Ole Opry and to get a change of clothes and pack your suitcase and head out again. I was single at the time, so I was living in a hotel and had one suitcase. And I had to really work on it to keep clean clothes for every night doing a show on the road.
My guest is Earl Scruggs. He's featured on the new CD, The Three Pickers, along with Ricky Skaggs and Doc Watson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is banjo player Earl Scruggs, one of the pioneers of bluegrass music. When we left off, we were talking about playing with Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys in the mid-40s. Now, it was in the Bill Monroe band that you met guitarist Lester Flatt, who became your long musical partner. What were your first impressions of him when you first heard him play and sing?
Well, I liked his singing, and his playing fit in good with that style of music, and we piled around together, you know, in a group. You kind of find one or two guys that you like better than the other part of the group, or the other maybe interesting things that you don't care for. So anyway, Lester and I got along with each other and roomed together, and so we did that for 2.5 or 3 years, and that's when really, we never had talked about starting a show ourselves, but I had made up my mind that I was going to just get off the road. So I worked 2 weeks' notice, and when I started to leave that night, Lester turned in his notice. And while he was working his notice, he gave me a call over North Carolina and said, why don't we get on the radio station over close to your home and try it as a group ourselves. So that's how we got started with the Foggy Mountain Boys.
Now you started recording. You and Lester Flatt started recording in, I think it was 1948. And for the first couple of years, you recorded for Mercury Records.
Uh-huh, yeah.
During that period, you recorded what became one of your best-known songs, Foggy Mountain Breakdown.
Yeah.
Is there a story behind the song?
Well, it's just a simple song that I probably wrote in 10 or 15 minutes. And and I've written several other tunes and had some pretty big hits, but nothing like Foggy Mountain Breakdown. You'll have a ringer, as I call it, one that might make a hit with just about everybody. And so Foggy Mountain Breakdown was one of them. And it got a lot of support, like in the film Bonnie and Clyde movie. They used it as a chase song, and that supported that tune a lot. So the tune did a lot for not only me, but it did a lot for a situation like that in a movie, like Bonnie and Clyde.
How did Foggy Mountain Breakdown end up being used in the movie Bonnie and Clyde?
He called and wanted me to write a tune for them.
Who called?
Warren Beatty,
mm-hmm.
who wrote and starred in the show. And so he called back. I think I'm quoting this exactly the way it was. In a few days, and he said he didn't want me to write anything because he'd found a tune that he thought fit what he wanted. See, we recorded that tune before they got what I say good equipment. I mean, just plain everyday microphones and a radio station and no to start making tunes sound fuller or something. It was just raw material. Well, that, I mean, it didn't have no echo chamber or anything on it. So that's what Warren Beatty heard in that tune. So he didn't want to try to record another tune because he thought that the equipment that they had then was probably would give it a more modern tune than what we had recorded, which turned out to be Foggy Mountain Breakdown and the sound that we got then.
So you're saying that he used the original recording and he didn't want you to re-record it?
He took the Mercury recording and that was it.
Why don't we hear that original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown? And this is Lester Flatt and my guest Earl Scruggs. Original recording of Foggy Mountain Breakdown, which was later used in Bonnie and Clyde, featuring Lester Flatt on guitar, Earl Scruggs on banjo. My guest is Earl Scruggs, and his latest CD is called Three Pickers, and it features him, Doc Watson, and Ricky Skaggs performing together. Now you mentioned when you got off the road with Bill Monroe, what you wanted to do was a radio show, and first you did one in Bristol. Then mm-hmm. in 1953, you ended up doing a radio show in Nashville at a station there. And
WSM, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I think, a 15-minute program every morning at 5:45, which is pretty darn early to have to perform.
We'd come in 2 o'clock and go to bed and get up at 4 to try to get awake enough to do a live radio program. But that was your bread and butter in those days. By that, I mean we made our living by the road work that we did. We'd go out and do shows and charge admission and get a percentage of that and also some flat rate, too. But that just put us to working in better,
the show,
bigger auditoriums and bigger crowds.
The show is sponsored by Martha White Flour.
Yeah.
And I understand the jingle for that became pretty well known, and you were even requested to play it at some of your concerts. I've never heard it. How did it go?
Now you bake bright with Martha White, goodness gracious, good and light, Martha White, for the finest biscuits, cakes, and pies. Gets Martha White self-rising flour. And the group says, the one all-purpose flour. Get Martha White self-rising flour. It's got hot rise. Hot rise was actually a baking soda that went into the bread that would, it makes bread rise. You know that yourself, being a lady. So, but I thought it was pretty cleverly written.
So did you get like a lifetime supply of free Martha White flour?
Oh, no. Oh, no. They would probably have done that. But I got a lifetime of work with Martha White. It's a great company, and they helped us just more than I could total up, I guess.
How long did that show last?
I wish my wife was in here. She could tell you better than me, but it lasted for a lot of years, and we went into television. Television came in about 1955, so they put us, we started transcribing the morning show, radio show, and we'd sleep late, but we'd have to do a live television show at a different city each night. And the reason I say a live radio, television, that was before they had cameras to film you with, so we'd leave 4 o'clock Monday morning to go to down in Georgia. Had two cities in Georgia, Atlanta being one. And let's see, Wednesday was Florence, South Carolina. Thursday was Huntington, West Virginia. And Friday was Jackson, Tennessee, down West Tennessee. And Saturday back at WSM Television. And do the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. And if we weren't working on Sunday, we were free until 4 o'clock Monday morning, and we started that 2,500-mile tour again.
Earl Scruggs plays with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs on the new CD, The Three Pickers. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And by Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how a high school English teacher learned that she is not one of those cool teachers you see in movies and TV, the teachers who get through to the kids no one had ever gotten through to before. Elizabeth Gold has written a memoir about teaching called Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity. And we continue our conversation with Earl Scruggs.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with bluegrass pioneer Earl Scruggs. He plays with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs on the new CD, The Three Pickers. Scruggs created the three-finger style of picking that became standard in bluegrass. In 1948, he and guitarist Lester Flatt left Bill Monroe's band to form their own group, Flatt and Scruggs, which became one of the most popular acts in country music and had the crossover hit Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Well, I want to ask you about another crossover hit that you had. And this, of course, was the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies, the Ballad of Jed Clampett, which got you like the number one record on the country music charts. It crossed over to the pop charts. And, of course, it was on TV every week for years. And it's still on a lot in reruns. How were you asked to write the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
I didn't write the theme.
I mean, to record the theme, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wish my wife was in here because she does all my business things, and she could tell you exactly how it came about. But we had done a show.
Wait, let me stop you. She's in the control room listening to the interview, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we invite her in, and she could tell us the story about the phone call. How's that?
She's on her way in.
Okay,
so
great.
So just hold that question. She'll be in a little bit. Now, Louise, say something, see if she can.
Hello.
Oh, that's much better.
One, two, three.
Great.
I can hear you in my headphones, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is this Louise Scruggs?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, can you tell us the story about the phone call inviting your husband to record the theme for the Beverly Hillbillies?
Well, Mr. Paul Henning, who wrote and directed the Beverly Hillbillies show, called before it went on the air. He had written the show, and he called and wanted Earl and Lester to do the theme music, and I turned it down at first because of the word Beverly Hillbillies. I didn't know what connotation that was going to take with country people and didn't want to offend them. So he said, well, what the premise of this show is that the Beverly Hillbillies are going to always be outsmarting the city slickers. So anyway, we talked about that two or three times, and he ended up sending the film, the pilot, to Nashville for us to see. And after we looked at it, we thought, okay, that looks all right. So they went ahead and recorded it. And while they were doing the theme music, I said to Perry Bodkin, who was a music director at the time, I think that would make a great single. And so I called Mr. Henning, and I said, what do you think about them recording that for a single for Columbia Records? And he said, I think it's a great idea. So I spoke to their A&R director, Mr. Don Law, who was doing their records at the time. And so they recorded it 3 weeks later. And then it was released in October, and December 8th, 1962, it hit number one in Billboard.
On the country chart?
Yeah, right. And then it was up in the pop chart, too.
Louise Scruggs, you handled the business end of Flatt and Scruggs. How did the theme song from the Beverly Hillbillies affect business for the band?
Well, after the show started airing, I started getting calls for them for dates and concerts, and within about a month, I had them booked up for a year in advance.
Okay.
So it was tremendous.
Well, Louise,
and eventually ended up being shown in 76 countries around the world. So what it did, actually, insofar as spreading country music, it helped country music, and it helped, well, in the banjo in particular, because Earl gets mail from people all over the world.
What will happen, too, I might inject here, that if you do something that makes a big hit, it's going to help all country music in general. So I think it really helped everybody that was on the road because it made more people aware of country music, and you're not going to get it all yourself. So it put a lot of people on the road to making playing bigger dates.
Well, Louise Scruggs, thank you for stopping in for part of the interview. We really appreciate it. Earl Scruggs, you're still there?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. So you and Lester Flatt do not sing on the theme at all, right?
No, we just did the music.
Just the music,
part.
Right? Good. Okay.
And Jerry Scoggins, a West Coast person, did the vocal on the theme that you hear on the Beverly Hillbillies. We did record it for Columbia Records, but that was later.
And when you recorded it, you sang it.
Lester did. Mm-hmm.
And why don't we hear the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies with Lester Flatt and my guest Earl Scruggs.
And listen to my story about a man named Jed. Poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. And then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling crude. All that is black gold, Texas tea.
If you're just joining us, my guest is banjo player Earl Scruggs. Now, why did you and Lester Flatt split up?
Well, the biggest thing for me, see, I had three boys coming along. Gary, Randy, and Steve was my youngest boy. And they were good musicians. And as a matter of fact, Randy had been recording with Lester and me as far as the guitar work ever since he's 7 or 8 years old. So I just had a band in my home, and one of the biggest thrills a person will ever get is to go on stage with his children, especially if they're good musicians, and I'll have to brag on them, even though they are my boys. I thought some of the best musicians I'd ever played with, because they had grown up listening to me. They knew everything that I did and could play it. Plus, they knew younger people's material, new material, and still they kind of made it sound like they were a Scruggs boy when they played it. So it was a great outlet for me to start working with my boys.
Did you stay close with Lester Flatt, and what kind of terms were you on when he died in 1979?
We were friends. I just didn't see him that much because I was on the road so much in the direction we were going. And he, of course, he kept to show himself, and he worked as long as he was able to work, really. Yeah. So I always, and still today, though he's been dead for several years, I still have a warm spot in my heart and cherish the days that we worked and traveled together.
There is a Gibson banjo that mm-hmm. is named for you. It's called the Earl.
Yeah.
It has a portrait of you
yeah.
on it and your signature. Is it a lot of fun to have, you know, a banjo that's dedicated to you, that bears your name and likeness?
It is. And as a matter of fact, they're making five different models with my name on it, from the plain banjo, which they're all basically the same banjo. What runs up the cost is like gold plating and engraving and things of that nature.
Do you play one of those Gibsons, or do you play something else?
Well, yeah, I play a Gibson banjo.
Is it an Earl?
Well, basically it is. I'm playing a banjo that I've been playing since back in the late 40s, I guess, early 50s. But it's still basically, they're still making basically the same banjo they were making way back there.
When you say you're still playing the same banjo, do you mean it's literally the same instrument or that it's the same model?
Yeah. Same banjo.
Same banjo. So do you have to get mm-hmm. it, like, redone occasionally?
Well, the only thing you're going to wear out on the banjo is the head. The head is used to be skin, but now it's plastic. They will wear out on you. And the strings, outside of that, you play one for 1,000 years unless you got it broken some way.
Now, what do you love so much about this banjo? Is it just a sentimental attachment, or is there something special about the sound?
Well, it produces the sound that my ear's looking for. Maybe I've just gotten used to it, but I like the sound that I get out of that particular banjo. I feel at home with it when I take it out of the case and start, you know, it's no... When you start with another instrument, they all have their feel, and playing the same instrument, you know what it's going to feel like when you take it out of the case and start to perform.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Been my pleasure.
Earl Scruggs plays with Doc Watson and Ricky Skaggs on the new CD, The Three Pickers. Here's a track from the CD Earl Scruggs and Friends, produced in 2001 by his son Randy Scruggs. This is a duet with John Fogerty, who used to be the leader of Creedence Clearwater Revival. Coming up, the misadventures of a writer who tried teaching high school English. This is Fresh Air. It's not easy teaching high school. If you want to know just how difficult it can be, consider Elizabeth Gold's experience. She was a poet who had taught writing to college students and young children when she accepted a position at a New York City public high school, taking over for a ninth grade English teacher who had left in the winter. It was in an immigrant, middle class, and working class neighborhood. Gold didn't get a chance to teach much literature. She was too busy trying to create order in her chaotic classroom. After hanging on for the remainder of the school year, Gold left high school teaching. She's written a new memoir about her experience called Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity. That's a play on Edgar Allan Poe's line, "I became insane with long intervals of horrible sanity." Here's a brief reading from Gold's book.
"Be a general, the principal has told me. And so, in the spirit of Lee or Washington, or maybe Douglas MacArthur, I very kindly, yet firmly, ask Ricardo to stop drinking that soda. He takes a nice refreshing gulp, and this is boring, I think to myself. Here he is, being a teenager, challenging me. Couldn't he be less predictable and quote Latin instead? And now Ricardo Silva and I are having the last discussion in the world I want to be having about why he won't put away that soda. And both of us are getting more heated, and everyone in the class is taking bets. Will he or won't he stop drinking that soda? And the sound is bubbling up. It is time for me to take control. I grab the can out of his hand. Give me my soda. No. At the end of class. Give me my soda. No. At the end of class. Give me my soda. No. Give me my soda. No. Soda. 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 Give me my soda. No. Give this man his soda. No. You owe me money. You took my soda. Give me my soda. Give this man his soda. No. Give this man his soda. No. Give this man his soda. I will give this boy his soda at the end of class. Ooh, says the class. And now, of course, this boy has transformed me into the kind of adult I can't stand, the kind of adult who cares about soda. Not that there isn't this little voice inside me whispering, oh, come on, let him have his soda. Drink up, Ricardo, drink up. Work on those cavities, flaunt that manhood. but give in to that voice, and I'm lost. Our struggle is not about soda, anyway. It's about the semiotics of soda. That's what it is, and I know that's what it is. It's not the soda, but what the soda means.
That's Elizabeth Gold reading from her new book, Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity, and it's about her teaching her short teaching experience. So you've just read us one scene about what your typical day was like, the fight about the soda, which is really a fight about who's in control here. Is it the student or the teacher? What were some of the other typical things that you had to demonstrate your authority with, or try anyways?
Well, let me see. I mean, first of all, simply getting people to be quiet in the classroom, getting people to follow tasks, getting people to take tests, getting people to turn to the right page, getting people to write assignments, basically anything. I mean, basically, there would be a small group of students who wanted to follow me, and it soon became a political issue about whether you're going to listen to me or not. So basically, I couldn't get students to do almost anything.
When a more experienced teacher would walk in and take control of your class, what could they do that you either didn't know how or didn't want to do?
Well, there were times when teachers would come in and they would replace me. First of all, I think they were more known by the students. I was a sub. And these students knew these teachers. Frankly, they were men. They were big men. They had low voices. They were less emotional than I was. I think that's a big part of it also. And also, I just think there is something about somebody walking into a room that creates a primal, oh my God, there's Dad, there's the disciplinarian, there's the power giver. There's something about that act of somebody walking into the room and interrupting that creates this kind of instinctual terror in students and in people, I guess. So, and I just didn't have whatever it was. I just didn't have that. And I was a sub.
Since it was so hard to create enough order in the classroom to actually teach a class, when on some occasions you were able to have order in the classroom, did you have a lesson ready to teach?
Well, not always. I mean, this is sometimes what happened is that you get so used to things not working out that the moments when things would become silent, I was often really surprised because also, in order to think realistically, you need quiet. So if the noise is bubbling up and then it becomes quiet for a minute, you kind of need about 5 minutes just to kind of collect your thoughts. And sometimes things would quiet down, and sometimes I did have a lesson that for some reason just kind of clicked. And I would almost have this feeling that I was racing against the clock, that if I didn't say incredibly interesting or challenging or just the right thing in just the right number of seconds, things would explode again. So every once in a while things clicked, but I never really knew why.
What's an example of something that clicked?
Well, here's an example of something where things were getting incredibly out of hand, and I began shrieking, "Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter." And for some weird reason, just hearing a line of John Keats just silenced the class. They'd never heard anything so wonderful. Someone said, "This is cool." And I had 5 minutes to talk about the concept of romantic poetry. And for about 5 minutes, I was able to do it. And then it just began roaring again. So we had a very, very small lesson in romantic poetry. So that's one.
Now, the high school that you were teaching in New York was a progressive school. It was part of the public school system, but it was part of an experiment within the public school system. What were the more experimental parts of the program?
Well, I mean, this was a school that was based on the idea. It was like a lot of these schools. There was a lot of parent input. It was considered a very democratic school. Everybody was called by their first names, you know, principals, teachers, students. There was a big stress put on actually by the principal. The principal had this big belief in this idea of that if you cared about the students enough, if you loved them enough, if you built up their self-esteem enough, that they would learn. There was also this idea of team teaching, that we're supposed to be team teaching. But to be quite frank with you, I didn't see any team teaching. There were also a lot of kind of peace counseling classes. And there was also a component where they went out into the community, which basically I think a lot of them did things like clerical work, but there was this component. So that were some of the components that I guess were considered more progressive and more experimental.
How did you like being called by your first name?
Actually, I hated it. I think that, first of all, the weird thing is when I talked to the children's parents, we called each other by our last names. So it would be Mr., Mrs., Miss. And I think that's because the truth is that sometimes what you really need is a little bit of distance, a little bit of formality, and just, you know, somebody does have to be boss. Quite frankly, somebody does. And I think, frankly, I think a lot of the kids actually wanted to call me by my last name because despite everything, they really didn't feel, they didn't need me to be their friend. So for me, it doesn't create warmth and closeness. That's not what does it. And a little formality is not a bad thing.
My guest is Elizabeth Gold. Her new memoir is called Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Elizabeth Gold has written a memoir about being a mid-year replacement teacher at a public high school in Queens, New York. The book is called Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity. Did you feel like this was the first time where people were going to decide whether to respect you or not based on a really different standard than you'd ever faced before? Because I think when you're a teacher in front of like a junior high or a high school class where it just goes with the territory that they're going to be challenging you verbally, physically. And if you're not used to that kind of physical challenge or that kind of, like, verbal challenge, and if you're a kind of introspective person,
yeah,
and not a kind of physical person, you can feel really lost.
Yeah, I did. And I think one is that when you become a teacher, especially in a situation like this, you suddenly are, you're like a stand-in for the adult world. You are an emblem, and a lot of the things which you are supposed to represent, you can't even recognize. I mean, part of my problem is I was supposed to lead these students to this magical future. And, you know, I was a sub. I was broke. I was, as I describe myself, a semi-published poet. And I didn't really know what my own future was going to be. And that's a very strange position to be this role model who had no inner life at all, no desires, nothing, just kind of a model of good behavior. That felt extremely alien to me.
Now, you taught high school, hated
right.
it.
Yes.
You taught college before teaching high school as an
yes.
adjunct. You're
yeah.
continuing to do that. You like that a lot. You've also taught like 8-year-olds in elementary
yeah.
school, taught them poetry. How'd you like that?
And oh, that's great.
What's great about it?
Well, one thing about teaching poetry to 8-year-olds is, you know, every 8-year-old is a genius. It kind of goes downhill from there. And you come in. You're not doing the disciplining. You are a treat.
You're the special poetry teacher?
You're the special poet. Yeah, you're sent in. You come in once a week. And kids, they love writing poetry. They love poetry. I mean, this is one of the awful things about sort of going through the system is you see kind of, you don't know where a lot of that natural imagination and creativity, where they go. And it was, I mean, it's not a, you know, you don't make a huge living at it, but it's really inspiring because you learn about a lot about human creativity, and they write poems and we enjoy it and it's fun. And I would always try to read, we'd always do like just a little piece of like an adult poem. So they wouldn't be, you know, it would be like a little bit of Wild Stevens or a little bit of Lorca. And so I think that was part of the reason I thought I could teach high school, foolishly enough.
You know, a lot of teachers, I think, go through a very similar hazing as the one that you did. And it almost is a hazing. It's a long testing period to see, can this teacher take it? Are they worthy of my respect? Can they gain control of this class? And, you know, a lot of teachers go through this hellish experience and they stick it through and then things quiet down at least a bit or things quiet down and things go well after that, depending. But, you know, after your substitute months were over, you left. And so you never kind of got to the point where you could have confidence that you could overcome these kinds of obstacles. So when you see high school age students now, do you automatically think to yourself, oh, they'd hate me? Oh, if we were in a room together, they would just insult me. They'd throw something at me. They would threaten me. They'd be obnoxious to me. In other words, has it left you with this fear that, well, this is the way young people are and young people don't get along with you?
No, not at all. I actually have a lot of empathy. And one of the weird things about being a teacher, some of my favorite students were students I couldn't control. Sometimes people act up because they're bored. Sometimes because they're doing the wrong thing. Sometimes they need a year or two. And one of the strange things, sometimes I would have a student in class who would be really wild, but you could see by the look in his or her eyes that the student was not mean, didn't really have anything against me. And then I'd run to the student kind of on the street, and the student would be really nice to me. So it was almost like there was something about being in that room that brought out the worst in a lot of people. There were actually a number of people in that room who I think if I'd been there from the beginning, maybe if I were a different kind of person, maybe if certain people weren't in the room, you know, some students who were bullies, who I think they would have liked to have learned something. They would have liked to have done something. And I felt a lot of empathy for these students because I felt like we were asking them to do a lot and to kind of ignore that bully in the corner. That's kind of a hard thing for an adult to do, and it's kind of a lot to ask a 14 or 15-year-old to do it. So as a matter of fact, I walked out with more empathy, but don't ask me to teach high school again.
Elizabeth Gold, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Gold's new memoir is called Brief Intervals of Horrible Sanity. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the University of Alabama School of Law, shaping the next generation, on the web at alabamalawschool.com, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood, by Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tales from the Far Side, we hear from cartoonist Gary Larson. A new 2-volume hardcover collection includes every Far Side cartoon ever syndicated. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.